Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we'll talk with historian Joshua Zeitz about some of his recent articles in Politico magazine, drawing parallels to today from the past. Those articles include a Trump-Biden tie would be a political nightmare, but maybe a boon to democracy. Biden can still win if he runs like Harry Truman. And four ex-presidents who ran again and what they mean for Trump. Joshua Zeitz is a historian, contributing writer to Politico magazine and New York Times bestselling author. His books include Lincoln's Boys and Building the Great Society. We'll talk with Joshua Zeitz following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to be talking with historian Joshua Zeitz about some of his recent articles in Politico magazine, which draw interesting parallels, attempt to draw lessons from the past. Titles of those articles include A Trump-Biden Tie Would Be a Political Nightmare, But Maybe a Boon to Democracy. Biden Can Still Win If He Runs Like Harry Truman. And Four Ex-Presidents Who Ran Again and What They Mean for Trump. Joshua Zeitz is a historian, contributing writer at Politico magazine, and a New York Times bestselling author. His books include Lincoln's Boys and Building the Great Society. He taught American history and politics at Cambridge University, Harvard University, and Princeton University. He's written for Politico, Washington Post, LA Times, Smithsonian Magazine, New Republic, and others. And he's a former gubernatorial speechwriter and policy aide. Joshua Zeitz, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be with you.
So gubernatorial speechwriter and policy aide, so you've had experience in the nitty-gritty of politics, also, history degrees, taught history, and I guess that's maybe what has led you to the current very interesting writing, drawing parallels to today from the past.
I think that's probably right. I've always been fascinated by history, and I used to be a history professor and still write and publish with a focus on political history. And, you know, we are living through some pretty unique times. So I think that history offers us a nice lens.
So a Trump-Biden tie would be a political nightmare, but maybe a boon to democracy. There are some nightmare elements to this, right?
For sure.
It is in this article, you kind of lay out how this is not so remote a possibility in the 2024 election. Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Remember that we are living in an incredibly polarized moment. So the number of swing states and even parts of swing states are pretty small. This election is going to ultimately be decided from an electoral college standpoint by a very small number of people living in just a handful of states, namely, you know, Nevada, Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Georgia, potentially North Carolina. And the one caveat I would add is that there are two congressional districts, one in Maine and one in Nebraska, which could be somewhat influential in determining the outcome of the election. But that's a pretty small number of people, and everybody agrees that those jurisdictions are going to be decided by a handful of people. I'm looking at a fun interactive electoral college map right now. And if you assume that both candidates hold everything that they held in 2020, however, Joe Biden picks up an extra congressional district in northern Maine, Nevada flips to Donald Trump, and Georgia remains blue, at that point you have an electoral college tie. So, this could move. I'm sorry, Wisconsin would have to flip under that circumstance as well. You would have a 269 tie, and there are a number of scenarios that are entirely plausible that could get there.
There are Republicans in Nebraska that have been talking about, at least, I don't know where this stands, about changing their rules so that it's a winner-take-all, like all states.
That's exactly right. There are two states that most states, 48 states, award all of their electoral college delegates to the winner of the statewide presidential election. Only two states have a combination of awarding them by statewide winner and congressional district, and those are Nebraska and Maine. And in the last couple of cycles, Democrats have won one electoral vote out of Nebraska because there's a congressional district around anchored by Omaha that's reliably blue. And Republicans have tended to do okay in one of Maine's two congressional districts in northern Maine, which is much more rural and resembles a kind of Republican, landscape more than Democratic one. Republicans understand the capacity for a tie or at least for a very close race. And so in Nebraska, they are attempting, the Republicans in the state legislature are still attempting to move to an at-large system like 48 states have. And that's in recognition that it could be, you know, this could be decided by one vote or two votes.
As we know, you have to get to 270 electoral votes to be elected president. And so you're looking at the possibility of a 269-269 tie. In that event, if that happens, what would happen then?
So in the event that there is a tie, let me put it another way. In the event that there's no candidate who wins an 270 electoral college votes, because in the past, and we can talk about 1824, there wasn't a tie per se, but because there were four candidates, each with some regional strength, nobody got a majority. But in the event nobody gets to 270, then it falls under the 12th Amendment, it falls to the House of Representatives to elect the president. But the caveat is that the House would vote by state delegation. So it's entirely possible, for instance, that Democrats could win control of the House of Representatives. In fact, I think most election observers think it's more likely than not that they will, but that the House would still elect a Republican president, namely Donald Trump, because today Republicans control 26 of the state delegations. Democrats control, the two of them are tied, and then Democrats control the balance. So, you know, under that scenario, Democrats would have to get from like 20, I guess they have 23 delegations. They have 22 delegations. So they would have to flip like three state delegations or four state delegations, and it's very unlikely that would happen. Could happen, though.
Yeah. So this is the 12th Amendment. I don't know if you looked into that, why they put this in. It seems a little clunky, but I guess they had to have a mechanism state by state.
Well, remember a few things. So there's the theoretical and the sort of governing philosophy and that was baked into the Constitution, and then there was the sort of the first several presidential elections which offered a learning experience. So, you know, in the early Republic, there were you know, states were supposed to have a significant amount of input into the federal governance. I mean, that was always the agreement, and it really wasn't until the Civil War, the 1860s, that the federal government itself became an entity that was basically free of states, right? Well, not free of states, but that was an entity that was considered, you know, something that stood alone. But in the early Republic, you know, there was a notion that this was a compact among states, and that is why the House of Representatives, for instance, was, you know, to hold a presidential election by state delegation as opposed to by simple vote. This was also a period when I think the understanding was that governing would be done at elite levels. There would be a lot of popular deference to social, economic, and political elites. That's why we have an electoral college system. And the idea really was that, you know, ultimately the selection of the president and vice president would be left to these people. And so what happened more specifically is that in 1796, you had a bizarre situation where when Washington stepped down, John Adams won the presidency, but Thomas Jefferson, through a sort of quirk, ended up, his rival in another political party ended up winning the vice presidency. That's because most Federalists stuck by Adams in the Electoral College voting for him for president, but they spread their votes out a little too thin among a couple of candidates for VP. And the Democratic Republicans were able to elect Jefferson as VP. And so you had this bizarre situation where the president and vice president were political enemies and not from the same party. And then in 1800, you had an even stranger outcome where the Democratic Republicans won resoundingly in the Electoral College. But the problem was that under the original terms of the Constitution, the Electoral College delegates would meet and each would cast two votes. And the runner-up would become vice president. So the winner of the Electoral College becomes president, the runner-up becomes vice president. The Democratic Republicans all stuck together, and they cast an equal number of votes for Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr, who were political enemies but both members of the same party. And so nobody actually was able to win a majority, an outright majority of the Electoral College. And so ultimately it fell to the House of Representatives under the original terms of the Constitution, but it was a mess. It required like 36 ballots to elect a president. And there was a realization that after the elections of 1796 and 1800, that, you know, clearly something was happening. Nobody had anticipated in 1789, when the Constitution was formed, that there would be political parties. It was considered something that would be inimical to good governance, but people had become more comfortable with it in some degree by the early 1800s, and there was an understanding that they had to fix this, you know, principally to make sure that you didn't end up with presidents from, you know, opposing parties and with presidents and vice presidents, but also to make sure that you didn't end up with, you know, an interminable tie in the House of Representatives. If you've seen the musical Hamilton, you'll know that the only reason that tie was broken was because the Federalist Alexander Hamilton was determined to stop Aaron Burr from becoming president. And so he got a couple of key state delegations in the House of Representatives that were Federalist controlled to switch and support Jefferson, even though he was not a member of their party. But they came up with the 12th Amendment as a way to sort of smooth out the process. And the idea was that you would still have an elite, you would still have a selection by an elite, you know, a group of people in the House of Representatives, but it would be done by state delegation.
Just parenthetically, it's interesting to me, at least, that Electoral College was among the institutions set up to favor elites, right? That there would be this deference to elites. And now you have Republicans, who, many of whom are anti-elite. A lot of anti-elite sentiment, in, at least among MAGA and the Trump base. But the Electoral College favors them, favors Republicans.
That's right. I mean, I think the posture is anti-elite. But to be very clear, the Republican Party has lost the popular vote in 7 of the last 8 presidential elections. And frankly, I think there's a good case to be made that they're going to lose it this time as well. But they've won the presidency 2 times without having won the popular vote, and they are increasingly reliant on a series of elite institutions and elite political structures that are anti-democratic in nature to maintain power. And that's everything from the structure of the U.S. Senate, which awards, you know, 800,000 residents or so of Idaho, the same number of U.S. senators that California gets with all of its, you know, 30 million plus or 40 million plus residents. I think it might be 50 million. They rely on that disproportionate power in the Senate. They rely on the Electoral College advantage, which awards, you know, every state 2 votes for its senators. They rely on the disproportionate power that comes from, you know, a 6-3 lopsided court, 2 members of whom were appointed by presidents who lost the popular vote. So they're increasingly reliant on those structures to maintain a kind of minoritarian grip on power. And I think that the real danger here is that, and you saw this in 1824, is that, you know, it's entirely plausible that a 269-269 tie, Democrats may have won the popular vote for the presidency. They may have retaken control of the House of Representatives by even a healthy margin, but the structure of the House delegations would be such that the Republicans would still maintain the presidency.
If you just joined us, you're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with historian Joshua Zeitz. We're talking about some of his recent articles in Politico magazine, interesting parallels today to the past and drawing some lessons. Right now we're talking about his article titled "A Trump-Biden Tie Would Be a Political Nightmare, But Maybe a Boon to Democracy." So, Joshua Zeitz, let's go back 200 years, exactly 200 years, the 1824 election, which Andrew Jackson had a pretty healthy majority, but didn't meet the threshold, right, to be elected.
That's right. That year saw a 4-way race for the presidency. Now, bear in mind that, you know, in the period between, say, 1800 and 1812, the Federalist Party all but died off in but a handful of places. And so you really had kind of one party rule between, you know, if we're going to be generous about it, 1810, 1812 through 1824. And it was Jefferson's Democratic Republicans, or Democrats, who effectively governed the country. And how did they choose their presidential nominees? Well, they chose them by congressional caucus. So the Democratic Republicans in Congress would get together in an 18, you know, 1808, they chose James Madison to be their standard bearer, and he easily won. And they chose him again in 1812, and he easily won. In 1816, they chose James Monroe. He easily won. They renominated him in 1820. The problem was that by 1824, you had a whole bunch of regional favorite sons who were strong within the party and who all were very hungry to have the presidency. So you had a four-way race between Andrew Jackson, Henry Clay, William Crawford of Georgia, and John Quincy Adams of Massachusetts, and all of them were Democratic Republicans, and all of them had a strong following, and there was no consensus in the House of Representatives as to who should be the nominee. And so you had a four-way race, and ultimately, given their regional strength, no one was able to secure an Electoral College majority, even though Andrew Jackson came in a pretty healthy first place in the Electoral College and probably in the popular vote. But it's hard to know whether he, you know, who won the popular vote, in the sense that up until 1820, the vast majority of states awarded their presidential electors, they appointed them by state legislatures. So state legislatures would literally award the delegates. It wasn't done by popular vote. Now, by 1824, 18 of the 24 states were actually awarding it by popular vote. I can get into, if it's interesting to you, why that is. But, you know, you still had a fair level of, you know, it was becoming a more democratic system. But because no one was able to secure the Electoral College majority, it fell to the House of Representatives to elect the president. And that was always going to favor someone who was more of an elite player.
So it was thrown to the House, right? And then there's some bargaining that went on, including famously the opponents charged John Quincy Adams and Henry Clay with striking a corrupt bargain.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so we think that Andrew Jackson almost certainly won the popular vote. When I say we think, you know, obviously in six of those states, the state legislature was still awarding the Electoral College delegates. So, you know, we can't say for sure, but in the 18 of the states that awarded it by popular vote, he had a clear and resounding popular vote majority. And he came into the House with, you know, a plurality of Electoral College delegates. But what happened was, you know, the following, that Jackson was seen by political elites as being a fairly dangerous, violent, intemperate, and populist figure. He didn't have good relationships with members of Congress, even though he had been a United States senator ever so briefly, and he had also been Secretary of War under Monroe. So he came in sort of as the outsider candidate, whereas John Quincy Adams, whose support was more regional, you know, and based in New England, he was a consummate inside player. His dad had been president. He was raised on politics. He had been a cabinet member. He was very intimate relations with, you know, terms with members of Congress. So he walked in with a sort of insider's advantage, and he was able to, you know, strike a deal with Henry Clay, who was the Speaker of the House at the time, Henry Clay of Kentucky, who had been a candidate for president that year. And whether they explicitly traded the position of Secretary of State for Clay's, you know, ability to swing a couple of state delegations, or whether they simply agreed that they wanted to stop Andrew Jackson and Clay was happy to help swing those votes to him, you know, is a matter of some dispute. I think most historians don't think that there was an explicit bargain. But what happened was that the two men met over dinner and they struck out a deal, and Clay was able to swing a couple of state delegations. And remember, you know, all you needed was the state delegation. So in the case of Illinois, there was only one member of Congress from Illinois, because it was a very young state at the time, but he was very much a Henry Clay ally and agreed to swing his votes to John Quincy Adams. And of course, even though there was only one member from Illinois and the Virginia delegation, for instance, would have been considerably larger, it didn't matter. They each had one vote. So ultimately, it didn't prove to be anything near as contentious as the 1800 election, which took like 30-some ballots. You know, John Quincy Adams was able to win the presidency on the first ballot.
So as you write in the article, John Quincy Adams won the battle but lost the war. How so? And there's some parallels to what could happen, I suppose. Mr. Trump could win the battle here, the presidency, but the Democrats could win the long game.
Potentially. I mean, from the moment he became president, John Quincy Adams had a mark on his back. And this is probably the first election that began 4 years before it occurred, right? Like, we're used to the long election cycle now, but like literally from the moment he was inaugurated, Andrew Jackson's partisans and supporters really began a protracted four-year campaign for 1828. And it was a real pitched battle. I mean, both, you know, the Democratic Republicans began to split into two parties. And by the early 1830s, they would be known as National Republicans, who were more of the John Quincy Adams types, and the Democratic Republicans, who would be the Jackson types. And you know, ultimately, they became Whigs on one side and just Democrats on the other by the 1830s. But you saw the rise of popular partisan press, which had happened in an earlier era as well. You saw sort of new modern campaign tactics like the organization, you know, the creation of local Jackson organizations in different states. You saw, pamphlets and political pamphleteering, the rise of campaign songs. And this is when politics as we know it really kind of came into its infancy in the mid-1820s. And it was very clear that these two were going to face off against each other again in 1828. And the problem for Adams was that it's played a very successful inside game in 1824, but that was really going to be the last time that would work, because the old system of elite governance and deference to social and political elites was quickly dying and giving way to the kind of popular democracy that favored someone like Jackson, who was way more popular with white male voters. And those were, of course, in most states at that point, the only voters, a couple of small asterisks to that. But, you know, in this intervening period, by 1828, all but two states were now awarding their electoral college votes by popular vote rather than by state legislature. The only two holdouts were South Carolina and Delaware. And so no one was going to be able to play that inside game, particularly in a two-way race where you weren't going to be able to count on the votes being so diluted that it would ultimately go back to the House of Representatives. And Adams was really forced by 1828 to compete on Andrew Jackson's ground, meaning a sort of more democratic process, which favored Jackson. I mean, I think what ultimately happened was that the country was moving from a sort of elite governance to a kind of noisy and participatory democracy on its own steam. But the outrage over the 1824 outcome accelerated that. It catalyzed it, and it made it almost inevitable that by 1828 this was going to be fought on democratic terms as opposed to, you know, by elite control. And so in many ways, it kind of, you know, it accelerated a process that was probably going to already happen anyway, but it made it happen a lot quicker.
You bring this forward to today. You write that, if similar dynamics were to result from an 1824 sort of contested Trump victory thrown to the House, if there were kind of a groundswell for reforms, possible reforms could include abolishing the Electoral College.
Sure,
that would make a lot of changes. Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry to interrupt. Yeah, I think that the parallels between then and now are that you had a system that was sort of sclerotic that was becoming. Let me try that again. I think the parallels between then and now are that you had a system in place that was really not designed to promote a popular democratic outcome, and you had a culture that had grown more democratic. And so, like in the case of 1824, clearly the direction that most states were taking was one in which, you know, there was an expectation that whoever got more votes would ultimately end up winning an election. And that is not what happened. And we know that was an increased expectation, given the number of states that had moved from a state legislative process to a popular vote process in awarding presidential electors. Now, today, in a similar way, you know, I think that it would be. I think that there is a popular expectation that whoever gets the most votes ultimately should govern the country. But in two cases over the last 24 years, that has not been the case. And in the scenario that I outline in the Politico piece, entirely possible that for the third time in 24 years, the loser of the presidential popular vote might become president. And to add insult to injury, he might become president through election in a House of Representatives that's actually controlled by the opposition party. And you have to wonder at what point the elasticity of this system is just going to snap. At what point will people say it's enough, that you can't continue to award the presidency to a country that has proven, you know, in this scenario, in 8 of the last 9 elections, incapable of winning a popular vote, and oftentimes losing it by millions. I think Biden won the popular vote by 7 million last time. You know, to what point are you going to say that it's okay for Democrats to win, you know, a majority of popular votes for the U.S. Senate, but to lose the Senate or to hold it only narrowly? There are other institutions like the filibuster and, frankly, the Supreme Court, which have grown increasingly anti-majoritarian. And I think that similar to 1824, you have to wonder at what point the electorate says we can't have this anymore and we demand some fundamental reforms. And that, to your point, that could come in the form of a, you know, an end of the electoral college. And it frankly doesn't even have to happen by constitutional amendment. There are other ways in which the electoral college could actually crumble if this were to, you know, come to pass.
Yeah, there are some other movements and reform efforts. Before we go to break, again, we're talking with historian Joshua Zeitz. I want to just briefly mention the election of 1876. This kind of thing is something that I could very well see happening in 2024. Rutherford B. Hayes against Samuel Tilden. In this case, Samuel Tilden fell short by one electoral vote of becoming president, because four states had contested slates of electors. Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's what Mr. Trump was trying to achieve in the aftermath of 4 years ago, right?
Could very well
try for that again this time around. But the result, I think, would be the same, be thrown to the House?
In that particular case, there was a compromise, and they sent it to a kind of special commission. It was like a one-off type of commission, so it was a slightly different outcome. But, you know, in this particular case, you could see some sort of scenario where, you know, one or two state delegations get thrown out, or that there's no agreement, you know, as to whether to accept or which electors to accept. And in that particular case, you could see it being thrown to the House. You wouldn't even have a tie. You would just have an inability to get to 270.
And,
so it's possible.
And then I guess you'd probably proceed under the 12th Amendment, go by delegation.
Yeah, that's right. And remember, Republicans would have every incentive to make that happen.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If they have the numbers in the House of Representatives to throw out a delegate, you know, to make that happen, they would have every incentive. They wouldn't, you know, you could see a situation where Joe Biden wins a narrow electoral college victory, but Republicans retain control of the House. And potentially, you know, 50 Senate seats or 51 Senate seats, and they ultimately vote to reject the electors in, let's say, Pennsylvania, in which case Donald Trump would not have a majority, but neither would Joe Biden, and it would go to the House of Representatives. So there is a perverse incentive system in there. Like, they wouldn't even have to, you know, award the electors to they wouldn't even have to award the state's electoral college votes to an alternative slate of electors. They could just simply reject the legitimate slate. And they'd have every incentive to do that in order to throw the election to the House.
So things could definitely get messy, and messier than they've been in many decades. I wonder, as a historian looking back, you know, there's a lot of fears about this, especially among Democrats, progressives, that our democracy is fraying. Do you take hopeful notes from the history? We've survived some of this, or pessimistic notes?
I'm more of a pessimist, I have to say. I think in 1824, most Americans agreed. They may not have agreed. There may have been disagreement about the mechanism by which presidents should be elected, but I don't think that there was a... In fact, I know, right? In 1828, John Quincy Adams barely lost that presidential election when he ran for re-election. And what did he do? He stepped down from the presidency. And I believe he attended, you know, Andrew Jackson's inauguration. He may not have, actually. But then he ran for the House of Representatives 2 years later, and he served, you know, something like 20-some years in Congress. So there was an understanding in 1824 among people of both parties that if you lost the election, you stepped down. You didn't try to hold the presidency. If you didn't win it, you didn't try to hold any office if you didn't try to win it. And unfortunately, I think that there's a breakdown in that right now, and it's not symmetrical. There's one political party, the Republican Party, that is dominated by a wing and by members of that wing who really can't accept the option of losing an election. You see that with Carrie Lake. You see it with Donald Trump. You see it with every election denier in every state where this has become an issue. You see it in among the majority of the House Republican caucus, which feels at least has to parrot the 2020, stolen election lie. And so you can't really have a democracy if one party refuses to lose elections. And so I am more of a pessimist than I think probably some of my readers might be.
Let's take a break. We're talking with historian Joshua Zeitz. He is the author of several books, including Lincoln's Boys and Building the Great Society. And he writes for Politico Magazine, Washington Post, LA Times, Smithsonian Magazine. At least he's written for those, The Atlantic, Dissent, New York Times, and writes periodic articles for Politico Magazine, drawing parallels to today from the past. We're sampling some of those articles today. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with historian Joshua Zeitz. He writes for several outlets, and including Politico Magazine. That's where I've been reading some of his recent articles, drawing parallels from the past to today. Joshua Zeitz, I want to go back to this one. This is from 2022, when former President Trump announced that he'd be running again. And you looked at four ex-presidents who ran again. I'd like especially to take a look at the only successful one. If Mr. Trump wins, he will become the second two-numbered president, right? He'll be number 45 and 47, two terms non-consecutive. Grover Cleveland was the other one. You look at, in this article, motivations for why these ex-presidents ran, and Grover Cleveland apparently did it out of boredom. He was out of office.
Yeah,
and
he really
wanted to get back
yeah.
in.
Yeah, he didn't really take to retirement. You know, he kind of ambled around trying to do a bunch of things and enjoy his a leisurely life, and it just didn't take for him. I think that he was a consummate politician. He enjoyed being in the mix, and so he didn't want to retire, which happens. You've seen that with some United States senators as well, who retire because they think they want to go spend some time with their families or the grandkids, and then they realize now they'd rather be in the Senate.
Teddy Roosevelt did it out of regret. I guess he had anointed his successor, William Howard Taft, and then I guess was disappointed in Mr. Taft's performance, wanted to come back.
Yeah, I think that's partly it, right? I mean, T.R. was more on the progressive wing of the Republican Party, and he expected that Taft might be as well. And historians have debated this. I mean, in reality, Taft probably didn't govern that with that much of a sharp difference from Teddy Roosevelt. But particularly in awarding a state patronage at the party level and in some of the people he associated with, Taft took a more conservative and stalwart position than T.R. And so Roosevelt ultimately decided that he needed to reclaim the mantle for the Republican Party. But I think that there was also an element of Roosevelt that regretted not having run for his own second term. Remember, he served almost two full terms because he became president in 1901 when William McKinley was assassinated and then was elected in his own right in 1904. And then he famously said the evening that he won the election that he would not run again. And it was the biggest political mistake he made in an otherwise very politically astute life, because he made himself a lame duck for the last 4 years of his presidency. And I think there was also an element of him that regretted that. And remember, he ran again in 1912, and he contemplated running again in 1916. So I think not dissimilar from Cleveland, he also wanted back in the action.
You say Martin Van Buren did it for power, wanted to get power back, and Herbert Hoover did it for spite. He hated FDR, who had defeated him. You talk a little bit about this. It occurs to me any and all of those reasons are probably ascribed to Mr. Trump running again.
Oh, absolutely. Although I think that there's a special one for Trump, which is that his personal freedom may very well rely on winning the presidency back, because he is under federal indictment in two different jurisdictions for two different alleged crimes. And he's managed to drag these trials out through a combination of a very friendly Supreme Court, again, one stacked with justices who, some of whom were not appointed by presidents who won the popular vote. And in the case of, there were other issues there, right? And he's also got a very friendly judge in Florida, but there's only so long he can, you know, hold that out. And, you know, I think winning the presidency for him is also a necessity in the sense that he'd control DOJ and also have pardon powers again. But for sure, I think, you know, it's a combination of boredom and spite and probably to some extent ideology, although less so, I imagine.
So I'd like to turn to another recent article. Biden can still win if he runs like Harry Truman. You know, right now, just like Truman, it doesn't look real good for the current president. Trailing in the polls, and the polls aren't seeming to be budging. Kind of conventional wisdom coalescing. You know, outline in brief for me how you think, what the blueprint would be that Biden should follow to follow Harry Truman.
Sure. And if you don't mind, I'm just going to like open with a shameless plug for Politico, because to your point, I write these articles these days almost exclusively for Politico. And Politico has a great column called History Department. I write for that. But they have a whole bunch of other very fine historians and public historians who write for it as well. And they're doing exactly what I do, where they try to, you know, we try to take some lessons from the past and use them as a lens to look at today. And, you know, it's said that Mark Twain once quipped that history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it rhymes, often rhymes. And I'm not sure he actually said that, but it's pretty good. I think it works. And that's what we try to do with this column. But, you know, in that piece, I looked at the parallel between Truman and Biden, and it's actually quite striking. If you look at what was happening in late 1947, early 1948, you know, coming off of World War II, the United States was grappling with runaway inflation, with high interest rates, with price shocks and supply shocks that were the aftermath of this, you know, kind of one-off event, which was World War II, in the same way that we're still grappling with high inflation, high interest rates, you know, supply shocks and price shocks owing to a one-off event, which was the COVID pandemic. And so the electorate was extremely grumpy, even though the economy was actually doing well by the numbers, other than those things. And Truman was just a very unpopular incumbent personally. And he also faced a really fractious Democratic coalition. You know, if you think about it, like FDR had held that coalition together in four straight presidential elections, but it was a pretty disparate, you know, coalition of conservative Southern Democrats and farmers and northern industrial workers, many of whom were, you know, white ethnic and African American, Jewish, and so keeping that coalition together was getting really difficult. And it was starting to unspool in 1948. In the same way, I think that Biden has this very, you know, kind of rich tapestry. The Democratic Party is way more diverse, both ideologically and demographically, than the Republican Party today. And it's really hard to keep everyone under that big tent. So they faced a lot of the same challenges. You know, Truman's approval rating in early 1948 was stuck somewhere in the mid-30s, just as Biden's has been, although I think his has gotten a little bit better in recent months. And two of his aides, Clark Clifford and Jim Rowe, wrote him a campaign memo, which really kind of outlined an improbable come-from-behind strategy. And a lot of the sort of wisdom in there, I think, is applicable to Biden as well. Part of it was that they had to, he said, you got to recognize that there is a rising importance of black voters in the Democratic Party. Obviously, black Southerners could not vote at this point for the most part. But the Great Migration North between World War I and the years after World War II were, you know, you saw a lot of black Americans now living in northern states where they could vote, and particularly in swing states, they became a really key constituency for both parties to compete for. And their advice to Truman was, you really have to go for those voters and try to swing them, because black voters had traditionally been Republicans where they could vote because of the party of Lincoln. And so he made a really concerted effort to embrace a stronger civil rights plank. And the parallel to today, I think I said in the article, was that Biden has a real opportunity in the aftermath of the Supreme Court's reversal of Roe v. Wade to lean in heavily on reproductive freedom, because that's going to be an important, you know, swing issue in key swing states. Another thing that they sort of argued, and I argued that Biden might consider doing, is that Truman positioned himself squarely in the center. He was vitriolic in and really strident in painting Republicans as being reactionaries, economic reactionaries and political reactionaries. But by the same token, he also distanced himself from the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, which actually split off that year and ran a third party candidate, former Vice President Henry Wallace. And, you know, so he positioned himself between the extremes on the left and the right. And I think that there's equally an opportunity, and if not an imperative, for Biden to do that now as well. And I wrote that piece well before the kind of campus protests and uprisings of 2024. So I think that, you know, there's even more of an opportunity for him to sort of position the Democratic Party as being, you know, squarely down the center, embracing the center left and center right equally, and in opposition to the extremes on the left and the right, in the same way that Truman did that year.
There's a few minutes left. I do want to have you at least mention or update an article from October of last year, just a few weeks after the Hamas attacks on October 7th. Take some lessons from history from 1967. I just want to read this paragraph. This is Joshua Zeitz. "We've been here before. If history is a guide, American Jews won't switch their political allegiances, though Republicans have been anticipating such defection for half a century, every 4 years. But they may react in ways that reshape the Democratic politics, activism, and fundraising. They may cool their ardor for progressive causes and organizations, may move more firmly to the center and urge the Democratic Party to follow suit." Talk about how American Jews are kind of caught in this crossfire, if you will, similar to 1967. Why don't you give me your two-minute version of this? Do you still feel this way now, some 6 months later?
Yeah, I certainly do. I think, you know, and I wrote a piece a couple of years ago for Politico as well, which looked at the perennial expectation that Jews were going to flip to the Republican Party, and it just never happens. It's like, you know, it makes the Republicans into Charlie Brown, and I guess in that context, we American Jews are Lucy with the football. I'm not sure, but you know, I don't see the American Jewish vote tilting this year at all. The option, you know, the options are pretty clear. A president, Joe Biden, who stood pretty steadfastly with Israel, and a former president who dines with white supremacists and anti-Semites. So that's not going to tilt. And most American Jews are center left. But I think that, as was the case in 1967, when many people on the left, you know, really turned against Israel after the Six-Day War in ways that really adopted anti-Semitic tropes and held Israel to a double or triple standard, I do think, just experientially, knowing a lot of politically engaged American Jews, many of whom have been, you know, held pretty influential staff positions in the Democratic politics over the last couple of years, a lot of them are pretty upset and disgusted by what they see on the left. And I think that, you know, American Jews will continue to be a pretty solid brick in the Democratic Party edifice, but they may be a lot cooler to cooperate with so-called progressives who really just didn't seem to have much concern for their experiences over the last several months, or much sympathy for the hostages in Israel or for the Israelis who suffered on October 7th. So I see this experientially, and I think just looking at history as a guide, particularly from 1967, I think that there could be a lot of daylight between American Jews and the Democratic coalition and the left. And maybe that doesn't matter in terms of numbers, but American Jews have been a pretty important part of the Democratic and liberal coalition since, you know, arguably the progressive era, and certainly since the New Deal era. And so they may not matter electorally, although in states like Maryland and Pennsylvania, which is a swing state, and Georgia, they might matter electorally. But I think it's more the case that, you know, there's going to be a kind of long-term division in the coalition. And, you know, that's not good for progressives or for liberals or for Democrats generally.
We'll reach the end of our time here. Joshua Zeitz is a historian. He writes for Politico magazine. He's written a couple of several books, including Lincoln's Boys and Building the Great Society. Those are available. Check those out. And History Department, right? That's the column in the Politico?
That's right. Got a revolving cast of writers. And if any of you out there listening are historians, you should definitely reach out to Politico, because I know they're always looking for a good perspective, particularly for history.
All right. Very good. Joshua Zeitz, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And we'll go out as we do on Tuesdays with Utah StoryCorps. Thanks, everyone.
It's time again for Utah StoryCorps, everyday people sharing their stories at the StoryCorps recording booth in Logan.
Hi, my name is Aria LaMalfa. I am 13, and I'm here with my dad.
I'm Eric LaMalfa.
Now?
Well, we talked about talking about theater.
Sure.
So you convinced me to try out for School of Rock, the musical, which is based on the movie with Jack Black. And I got so excited. I ended up getting three little minor roles, and you got the lead role. You play the cello, but you learned to play the bass, and then you join this kid rock band. The whole culmination for me was the final scene of School of Rock. You guys are all on stage, and you were standing on a box, and you're playing the bass, and you're killing it.
Got my pigtails in, golden shoulder pads.
White Doc Martin boots.
I had the whole cast sign them, and then I wore them on closing night.
And you're making
the Katie face.
Puckered lips. And you were jamming, and then they shot the confetti. That's etched in my mind. And you guys seriously rocked. I was so into theater when I was your age. And I bottled it up and forgot about it. And while we were doing that, I rediscovered I love doing theater. And then we were doing it together. And I was so proud of you.
I was watching you, and it was really good. You have like one line where you would be like, what a lightweight. And you would start swinging your jacket around and you
doing
hit
a disco dance.
You hit somebody in the face.
And
so
her
funny.
Glasses would fall off.
I remember Emmanuel, he was like, Aria, your dad never gets old. So funny.
That means a lot to me. And this kind of leads into how old were you when you wrote the neighborhood musical?
Like 9.
You were 9 and you wrote it with your friends on Google Docs, and you rehearsed it in the yard, and you built a set out of cardboard, and this was all just you guys. You've always written stories.
I remember Evelyn, I gave her like a lead. She was like freaking out. And so I was like, don't worry, Evelyn, it'll be okay. You just gotta get out there.
You've always been very bold and fearless, and you really have a big heart. The other day, you're 13 years old, and you were over at the park hanging out, and me and Stella, your sister, rode by, and you and your friends were like, hey, Stella, come over here.
We were having a mock trial.
You were having a mock trial, and you wanted her to be the judge.
Yeah.
It's just cool that you include your sister in things. Those little moments, I'm so proud of you.
I guess I was proud that you did the theater with me. I know it took a lot of convincing for me and Mom to get you to do that, and I was really happy that you did. And I think it was a bonding experience for us.
Something. It was.
But, like, you have your band, the Highline Drifters. It's cool. And I guess with my music stuff.
Yeah, you're going to start a band over the summer.
Starting a band.
What are you calling your band?
Hopefully Kenshi Bushechas.
And what's Kenshi Bushechas?
Hot Cheeks in Portuguese.
I love watching you be you.
And this is Utah StoryCorps. Thank you for coming along. See you next Friday. Same time, same place.
Support for Logan StoryCorps comes from Cache County and from USU Credit Union, a division of Golden West.